To be honest, I'm a bit scared, dear people. Anyone who remembers the episodes about the German throne controversy will know that things can quickly get complicated when it comes to supra-regional conflicts involving Cologne. Too complicated for radio play, like a podcast. And here we are again, the Limburg War of Succession. A supra-regional conflict that was decided at the gates of Cologne in 1288, literally speaking. Surprise, 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 we are currently in the big topic block, the Battle of Vorringen. The battle that was decisive for Cologne's future history in 1288, or was it not? In this episode, we will deal with the Limburg War of Succession as a supra-regional conflict that will lead to Cologne citizens taking part in one of the bloodiest and largest night battles of the German Middle Ages in the fields in the mud of a Rhine meadow near Vorringen, north of Cologne. Something that, as you know, I don't find cool or use as an exaggeration to build up dramatic tension. No, it really was a battle with a comparatively high number of casualties for the era. After many previous years of conflict, the Battle of Vorringen was to be the decisive battle in the Limburg War of Succession. This time, I would like to show you the years leading up to it, the road to Vorringen, so to speak. In this episode, we shed light on this, and above all, we have to ask ourselves the question, what does Cologne have to do with all of this? The answer is very clear and will surprise some of you. Have you ever inherited anything? Hand on heart, did it always go smoothly? Especially if other family members were involved? It happens in the best families, even among the nobility in the Middle Ages. The only problem is that they didn't use lawyers, but dealt with it the old-fashioned way, by force. And there were some good things to inherit here. The River Meuse in particular, with its trade in goods, made it so lucrative for the rulers of the time to get a piece of it there. Oh my goodness, what have I actually got myself into with this podcast? Another conflict with so many people involved. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne. My name is Willem and I'm telling you the long 2000-year-old history of the city of Cologne. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Cologne is like a microcosm of European history, so there's lots to learn for you here. Why did the succession in the Duchy of Limburg plunge the northwest of the empire into chaos? By the way, we're talking about Limburg in what is now the Dutch-Belgian region, not Limburg on the Lahn and Hesse. In the following, we will shed light on the cause of the conflict and roughly discuss the relevant players. In a future installment, I would like to go into more detail about the dominions and people involved. Because I'm sure that you didn't know where the Duchy of Brabant, the County of Mark, the County of Geldern, the Duchy of Limburg, or even the County of Kleve were located any more than I did. As I said, I'll leave who and where that was for another time. And at the end, let's answer the question of what the city of Cologne actually had to do with all of this. The House of Limburg had landed a major coup at the beginning of the 13th century. With their duchy, they ruled an area that today runs along both sides of the A4 motorway between Aachen and Liège in Belgium. They fought bitterly against the Archbishop of Cologne, Engelbert I, who was actually their superior feudal lord. With the assassination of Engelbert I, the county of Berg came into the possession of the Limburg dynasty. A generation later, in 1246, the Limburg line split. One line ruled the newly quiet county of Berg, the other remained in Limburg itself. And this was exactly what was at stake now, the Duchy of Limburg. The Duchy of Limburg was ruled by Duke Walram IV from 1247 to 1279, a very long period of rule. But of course it came to an end at some point, and so it did. Duke Walram IV of Limburg died in 1279, other sources say 1280. Historians, please get clear on that, please. It really is confusing for me. The Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried von Westerburg, whom we already know, had married him, the Duke Walram IV of Limburg, to Kunigunde von Brandenburg just a year earlier. During their brief marriage, the couple had obviously no children, however. Vahram had a daughter named Irmgard from a previous marriage who was now married to Reinald, Count of Geldern. Irmgard was the only child of the deceased Duke of Limburg. This meant that Irmgard, the wife of the Count of Geldern, was now the sole heir to the Duchy of Limburg. The main beneficiary was, of course, in a patriarchal system, I cannot pronounce it work, sorry, her husband, the Count of Geldern, who thus automatically became Duke of Limburg through his wife Irmgard. So why was there a dispute, and then even a war over Limburg, if the case is so clear, like in that case? Well, if that wasn't enough, Irmgard only outlived her father by 4 years. She dies in 1283, also childless. And so the previous Limburg line, not to be confused with the line in Limburg an der Lahn, as I said, came to an end in this dominion. However, it continued to exist in the county of Berg. And this is where things start to get complicated. Although, actually, the arrangement's clear. Count Reinald of Geldern has the right of use over the Duchy of Limburg for as long as he lives and may also call himself Duke of Limburg. After all, he is the widower of the deceased Limburg heiress Irmgard. However, as he had no children in common with Irmgard, the fief would expire after his death. It would be virtually free. And according to ancient law, since at least Charlemagne, it would now be up to the king to grant it anew to a noble family. If things were perfect, but no sooner said than done, King Rudolf I of Habsburg decreed exactly that. Applicable law was to be implemented. Count Reinhard of Geldern would remain, as I said, Duke of Limburg for as long as he lived, and he did so for quite a while, until 1326 to be precise, so another 40 years or so. The only problem was that we dealt with it in the last episode. The king's power had been enormously weakened by the preceding period of the interregnum, the time without an emperor. Worse still, Rudolf I was an intelligent and cunning ruler from the House of Habsburg, but he no longer had the full power of a Hohenstaufen, for example. And so it came to pass that royal law was pronounced in 1283, but being right and enforcing the law were two different things, and the latter did not succeed. The king's ruling was simply ignored, and several rulers in the region set about seizing Limburg for themselves as soon as Irmgard died in 1283. And of course, the Count of Geldern did not want to be deprived of his rightful title of Duke of Limburg, and so the Limburg War of Succession began. We have already touched on why there were wars of succession. A power vacuum at the head of the realm, competing legal claims, and let's be honest, above all, the strategic power interest of individual players. What does that mean in concrete terms? On the one hand, there is a lack of royal authority, but it also means that for a variety of reasons, claims to power could be made out of thin air if you were only distantly related to the whole thing. Let's take a quick look at the players who laid claim to Limburg. There were so many of them that they were almost queuing up to get their hands on the important and rich Duchy of Limburg. As I said, more about the rulers, or rather the territories they rule, in another episode. We have Count Reinhard of Geldern, of course, as the widower of Irmgard. The following were also related to the deceased Duke of Limburg, or to Irmgard in some way. I think I'd better spare you the details, that sort of things always confuse me. But these men were Henry of Luxembourg, from the joint house of Limburg-Luxembourg, so another Limburg line that had split into another line, the later Luxembourg line, with Charles IV, for example, who made Prague big and glorious. Then we have Vahram of Falkenburg, not to be confused with the already deceased Vahram of Limburg, please. Then we have Gerhard of Durby, a member of the House of Luxembourg as well, who as descendants of a deceased Duke of Limburg that came earlier were also de facto Limburgers. And of course we have Adolf V of Berg, Irmgard's first cousin and nephew of the deceased Duke of Limburg. He was related to the extinct House of Limburg because, If you remember, the House of Berg once got Limburg at the beginning of the 13th century and then split into Limburg and Berglein. As I said, it's complicated. And before it gets too complicated, as mentioned in the intro, after several changes of alliance, two blocks emerge shortly before Vöhringen, which are hostile to each other and would clash in Vöhringen on the battlefield in 1288. Firstly, the first block is the Count of Gelden, of course, Reinald, the Count, who had even received the orphaned Duchy of Limburg from the king throughout his life. Reinald faces a superior force of enemies. He needs strong friends to win. So it was good for Reinhard that the Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried of Westerburg, was following the current developments with concern. Because should Limburg fall to the House of Berg, as demanded by Adolf V of Berg, this would threaten all the possessions of the Cologne Archbishopric along the Rhine. It would even threaten the extraordinary power of the Archbishop of Cologne in this region. As you know, the Archbishop of Cologne is one of the most powerful princes in the empire, ruling not only Cologne but also numerous other territories along the Rhine and Westphalia. Count Reinhard of Gelden and the Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried of Westerburg, conclude an alliance, and both were the leaders of this block of those two that would clash in the Battle of Vöhringen in 1288. Adolf von Berg would certainly have loved to get hold of the Duchy of Limburg. However, it was too far from his own dominion, which was largely on the right bank of the Rhine. But in between lay territories belonging to Jülich and the Archbishopric of Cologne itself. So the Count of Berg had a useful idea. He officially renounced Limburg, but then ceded his claim to another regional player who could be dangerous for everyone else, but not for him, the County of Berg. Count of Berg, to be more precise. This is how the second block emerges. Adolf von Berg saw this ruler in Duke John of First of Brabant. Brabant is roughly today's Lower Belgium with Brussels and the city of Antwerp. As I said, we will deal with the territories of the parties to the conflict another time. But the Duke there was only too keen to extend his rule as far as east to the Rhine. But wait a minute, you might ask, what kind of family ties did John of Brabant have with Limburg that he now threw also his hat into the ring? Well, none at all. The Berg-Brabant camp quickly made up for the legitimization. A son of the Duke of Brabant married a niece of the Count of Berg, and then poof, Brabant had a claim to Limburg. Albeit a very vague one. Of course, Adolf of Berg did that not without anything in return. He made the Duke of Brabant, of course, pay for it. As soon as this was completed in 1283, Brabant invaded the neighboring Duchy of Limburg. This was not difficult for him because he had bought the former imperial fortress of Kerpen shortly before and was therefore under the rule of Brabant. Exactly, you American or British listeners, Kerpen, the famous city of Michael Schumacher, the great German racing driver in Formula One. We all don't know in what condition Michael Schumacher is right now, but I hope he's doing well regarding his circumstances. And did you know that I met him once when I was a little child? But that's maybe a story for another time, not for a history podcast. The other alliance, consisting of Gelden and the Archbishop of Cologne, is now in great distress due to the entry of the powerful Duchy of Brabant. But this is where the military conflict really begins. Both sides overreach each other with violence. This was particularly bad for Limburg, the region, and the people living there. The entire duchy was the theater of war between 1283 till 1288. The lower nobility in Limburg itself was divided over the question of who to swear allegiance to, Brabant or Gelden. And what was even worse, the Limburg elites often fought each other during the War of Succession. They were divided as to whether they were on the side of Gelden or Brabant. Until the end, on the battlefield at Vöhringen in 1288, where two local big noble Limburg families would fight each other to the death. That's how tragic it was. What now began was a wild hustle and bustle of shifting alliances between various rulers, each from one of the two camps. On the one side, as already mentioned, the alliance from Brabant and Berg, and on the other side, the Archbishopric of Cologne with Geldern together. The Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried von Westerburg, gathered well-known allies around him, like the Count of Kleve. Brabant, in turn, secured the support of Count Eberhard von der Mark. The first clash between the two camps took place in what is now Gulpen-Wittem in the Netherlands, I believe. The decision was almost made here, in the province of today's South Limburg. But when both armies faced each other and were ready for the bloody dance, Franciscan monks mediated on both sides and convinced them that there was no need for mutual murder. Two independent neutral arbitrators were to decide who would receive Limburg. This should settle the conflict peacefully. The two arbitrators were the Count of Hennegau and the Count of Flanders. They were appointed as arbitrators. And less than a year later, in July 1284, they issued their arbitration judgment. Applicable law was to be applied. King Rudolf I of Habsburg had said what was to do. He had given Reinhard, the Count of Geldern, the Duchy of Limburg as a fief for as long as he lived, as he was the widow of the last Limburg woman, Irmgard. So, it was decided, wasn't it? Well, as I said, being right and being proved right are two different things, or getting your right. As much as the Lions of Geldern and the Archbishop of Cologne were pleased with the arbitration ruling, the other side, led by Brabant Berg, ignored it, simply. And yet, from 1284, the conflict was officially suspended. Neither side dared to expose itself to the other. This went on for 2 years. However, both sides did not remain inactive during this time. Both sides gathered their allies together so that, as already mentioned, it was no longer just about Limburg, but about supremacy in the entire northwestern part of the Holy Roman Empire. In 1286, there was renewed movement in the conflict. Count Reinhard of Geldern, who continued to see himself as the official Duke of Limburg through his deceased Limburg wife, remarried, this time to Margaret of Flanders, in order to secure the loyalty of the Count of Flanders. His dominion of Flanders lay at the back of Brabant, seen from Cologne and the Duchy of Limburg, which would hem the Duchy of Brabant in by enemies on both sides. This caused the fighting to flare up again, albeit still far away from Cologne. Duke John of Brabant immediately invaded Flanders with an army to prevent the encirclement of his territory. However, the year of 1268 ended without success. Instead, the Brabant-Berg side celebrated victories in the diplomatic arena. They actually managed to convince one of the oldest and most loyal allies of the Archbishop of Cologne to stop taking sides with Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg in this conflict and to position them as a neutral party from then on. We are speaking about the Count of Kleve. He now remained neutral. John of Brabant must have been very skillful at diplomacy. He also managed to win over another supporter of the Archbishop of Cologne for his cause, the Count of Jülich, to his side, and remind him that his father, in particular, had been a bitter enemy of the Archbishops of Cologne. I'm speaking of the Count of Jülich, of course. Something we have heard many times here already in this podcast. To the advantage of the citizens of Cologne, who had often allied themselves with the Count of Jülich, this old family tradition was now revived. 1288 was initially a difficult year for the opposing side, which was led by the Archbishop of Cologne and Count Reinhard von Geldern. They had lost many allies to Brabant Berg, and so the Count of Geldern was forced to do something that the Count of Berg had already done a few years earlier. The Count of Kleve knew he would never be able to establish himself in Limburg. He therefore also sold his claims to the Duchy of Limburg for a lot of money to someone else. And that was the House of Luxembourg. The House of Luxembourg was a powerful noble family in the Holy Roman Empire. They were about to make their grand entrance into the history of the empire. From the 14th century onwards, the Luxembourgs played a decisive role in shaping the fortunes of Bohemia, Hungary, and Croatia, among others, and the whole empire, of course. Four representatives of this family were to become rulers of the Holy Roman Empire during this period. First and foremost, Charles IV, who will go down in history as one of the most famous emperors of the Holy Roman Empire and one of the most important medieval rulers in Europe. And yet, the acquisition of the House of Luxembourg was a clever move. The remaining possessions of the Luxembourgers are located far away from the Rhineland. From the point of view of the Archbishop of Cologne, a Luxembourger in Limburg was less dangerous than a Duke of Brabant, who would thus significantly expand his neighboring territory. On the contrary, Luxembourgian Limburg would be the perfect buffer against Brabant, allowing the Archbishop of Cologne to retain full control of the Rhine, and even if he had to pay dearly for it. Adolf of Nassau, a relative of the Archbishop of Cologne, was hired also by the Archbishop of Cologne, who would soon become king. So it's always good to have a future king in your ranks. So, dear people, as I said in the intro, I realized that all the names of the rulers and the titles must make your head spin. I told you I was scared, as I've been since the German throne controversy. Here in this podcast, that the facts are too complicated for a podcast format. So I'll end with a simple summary. So too long didn't read. There are two sides in this conflict who officially want to secure rule over Limburg. The Count of Berg, who sold his claim to Brabant, in the hope of also emerging victorious from this conflict in the long term, as a Limburg under Brabant leadership would considerably weaken the Archbishop of Cologne. On the other hand, we have an alliance led by the Archbishop of Cologne and the Count of Geldern, who has now also sold his claims to another family, to the Luxembourgers. Brabant did a slightly better job of gathering more allies, but nothing had been decided at the beginning of 1288. The history was not already written in the books. It was more of a stalemate, and each side was hoping to win the upcoming battle. By the time of the Battle of Worringen, both armies would be almost the same size and identically organized, making it one of the largest battles of medieval Germany. Limburg was no longer really the issue here. It was more about who held power in the northwest of the empire. Would the Archbishop of Cologne continue to do so? Or perhaps would others do that in the future? So, dear people, for a whole episode now, all you've heard is talk of rulers on the Rhine and what is now the Netherlands and Belgium. And yes, it was also about the Archbishop of Cologne, but here more in his role as a territorial prince in the Holy Roman Empire, less as the direct city ruler of Cologne. Hence, the quite legitimate question, this is a podcast about Cologne. What does this long-standing conflict have to do with the city of Cologne? And the answer is very simple and short. Absolutely nothing. The conflict had nothing to do with the city of Cologne. Yes, of course, when war is waged in the region, Cologne's merchants are not unaffected. Long-distance trade is always affected by conflicts. Of course, the merchants of Cologne would not have liked it at all. But remember the episode about Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg, one of the two leaders in this Limburg succession dispute. He had made a friendship alliance with his own city of Cologne in 1275. This stipulated that they, the citizens of Cologne and the Archbishop of Cologne, would not enter into opposing alliances. So the matter was actually clear. The city of Cologne faithfully stood by its Archbishop in the conflict. Or at least it was neutral and would not take any sides. In 1287, a year before the Battle of Worringen, the Archbishop of Cologne decided to play it safe once again. He had this alliance of friendship from 1275 with Cologne renewed, and the citizens of Cologne, the city council, the Richterzeche, and the jurors all voted yes in favor for it. So, meaning the city stood loyally by the side of its city lord, the Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg. However, an offer would soon be made to the people of Cologne that would ensure that a year later, the archbishop's troops and the armed contingents of the citizens of Cologne would face each other not as allies, but as enemies, mercilessly killing each other in the Battle of Worringen. We will find out how this could happen another time. So that was the story of the Limburg Succession War, from its beginning until shortly before the Battle of Worringen, which will decide this war. I hope you were able to follow along at least a little bit. Next time, I would like to look beyond the horizon again. Many of the rulers involved here and their territories have long since been absorbed into areas of modern-day Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Historical territories that have mostly been forgotten. That's why I would like to talk about some of them. But don't worry, not all of them. Who they were, where they were, and why they took part in the great struggle for power in the northwest of the empire. I used the following literature. Vera Torinsky, Worringen, 1288, Ursachen und Folgen einer Schlacht, meaning Worringen 1288, causes and effects of a battle. Then Der Name der Freiheit, 1988, so meaning the name of free, in the name of freedom, 1288 to 1988. This was a book that came out because it was the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Worringen. And of course the classic Köln im Hochmittelalter by Karl Dietmann Hugo Stehkämper, meaning Cologne in the High Middle Ages. Thank you very much for listening. Please recommend me further and rate this podcast. And as always, auf Wiedersehen.